92.3 Free FM. WFNY FM. New York. David Lee Roth on 92.3 Free FM.
Super Highway. Coast to coast. Easy to get anywhere. Straight up the middle, baby. That's where I go. Slide behind the wheel, honey. How does that feel? No destination that's too far. Somewhere along the way, we'll find out who you are.
Yours truly, David Lee Roth. Music, attitude, spoken word, Zen, and the art of mojo maintenance.
Hubcaps. Trailer parks and heart attacks.
Check it out.
Yeah. You got that.
Life is slow when the groove is on.
I got an email here from Clyde, Ohio. Kempian, manorexia? Yeah. Dave, let's be sensitive for a second. Okay, that's long enough. Hey, Dennis, eat a sandwich. I read the article here. It says actor Dennis Quaid said he's getting professional help for what he calls manorexia, the male version of anorexia. And in an interview with Best Life magazine, he said that his eating disorder apparently began in 94 when he prepared for the role of Wyatt Earp. And that now he is talking about the problem so that others can get help. Better this than the rainforest, finally. A subject that everybody's grappling with, huh? And I raise the question, is anorexia, manorexia, or the general the preferred version, the female version, is this rich people's disease? Is this only the upper class has this? Because you rarely hear about this in the black community. You rarely hear about this in the Latino community, you follow, and you almost never hear about it in places like Africa or the Mideast or whatever. I gotta wonder if this is sports specific here. Go ahead and start picking up from the top there, Hutch. Take the numbers. 866-313-3733. Are you young and skinny? Go ahead. John, are you an anorexic?
No, I'm a Rothaholic.
Okay, so what do you think? What do you think of manorexia, besides it being a great name for a heavy metal band? Does this exist, or is it BS?
Let's call it like we see it, total BS. Let's just say that Quaid hasn't put out a good movie in how long? Let's just say, you have an OCD complex. Go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Get the problem fixed. What it comes down to is people in America being lazy, looking for an easy way out, for sympathy, a cop-out. Go to a doctor. Get treatment for it. There's no such thing as manorexia.
You know what? I'm almost going to agree with you. I still haven't received some other calls that might corroborate what he is supposedly feeling here. But this is an interesting twist in that he's successfully accomplished what every single diet and every single diet program on television and every single diet pill that's being pandered to us on late-night television, he has successfully accomplished what all of that ambition indicates is the way to be, right? He finally lost all of the weight, and now he's wearing it as a disability. You agree or disagree?
I totally agree with you. And I don't always agree with you, but I still love you. But here's the bottom line. What he has done is he has totally lost all the body fat, built his body to a system where it's used to not accepting fat, watched himself, and now he's become obsessive compulsive with it, and now he's looking for a sympathy card to throw into play because now, hey, look, I'm too skinny, poor me, let's do Oprah, let's do Dr. Phil, let's get some publicity out of it. Well, no crap, anybody can do that.
You know what? I think you got a point. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Roth Radio. Let's see if somebody has a contrasting view here. Pick Jennifer. Come off number 8 there, Hutch, and see what she says here. Because more frequently than not, this is depicted as a female inherited kind of calamity here. Jennifer, you're on. Roth Radio, you there?
Yes.
What do you think?
Inherited than developed, I think.
Okay.
And I point the causes directly towards the female being subject to the male gaze throughout history and throughout our lives. It's a typical technique of painting where, you know, you're looking into the scene, and what is it that you're seeing is you're seeing the perspective of the male gaze. And we all know that men are very visually oriented.
I don't get the connection. Re-explain that to me, Jenny.
Well, because if you're being subject to the male gaze, and the males are very visual, and they're looking for a particular look in the body of a female, and that would put tremendous pressure on someone to conform to that ideal. And so where women have been subject to this for a very long time, and you've seen it develop, especially in dancers, which are also being looked at, you know, from an audience's point of view, now in Hollywood, where it's like a super intensified male gaze, it's now being directed at men as well.
Okay, so what you're saying is that gay males are the ones who have created this template that women are supposed to live up to, and that it is gay males perhaps behind the scenes in movies?
No, no, no. It started with the straight male. I mean, it's males in general. Males are more visually oriented. Females are more mentally oriented. It's just the way that we're programmed. And so,
what's your point? What's your theory, Jennifer?
Well, my theory is that now that we're stepping into the 21st century, and yes, now you have more of a gay male influence where you're having the male gaze directed at males, and therefore it's creating more of a the feeling of the recognition of the pressure to conform to the ideal. And that's where you're getting ridiculous behaviors like anorexia and bulimia.
Okay, so you're blaming it on the gaze.
Not the gaze, G-A-Y-S-G-A-Z-E, the male gaze.
Oh, you are completely the best attorney I have ever spoken to. You completely had me lost out there. So you're saying the male gaze, G-A-Z-E, like males looking at women.
Which is why my art parallel was trying to clarify that. You know, when you see a scene of a woman, you know, acting demurely, what is she acting in response to the male gaze?
I got you. The way the fellas are looking at her. Okay,
yeah,
so she's playing to the audience. What audience are fellas playing to now?
The male audience, in fact. We're now performing for ourselves, or you all are.
Well, you know what it is that all guys see each other as brothers. I've made this description before. Women are always competing. You can have two great-looking women sitting at the bar. Another great woman walks in through the door, and they go, that bitch, who does she think
That's
she
right.
is, right?
Yep.
You can have two fat slobs sitting at the bar. Arnold Schwarzenegger walks in looking all buff. We go, hey, bro, come have a beer.
Right.
So we got to add up to the tribe, and women are competing with each other. Would you agree?
Yes.
And do
yes.
you think that anorexia is a rich person's affliction?
Well, I think it's a lazy person's affliction.
Yeah, but who's lazier than the rich?
Exactly. If you haven't had to work for anything in your life, why start now?
Start working on yourself from the inside out. Thanks for giving us a call. 866-313-3733. Karen, I think, actually is an anorexic here. Go ahead and dial her in, Hutch. Karen, Roth Radio, you're in.
Hi. Yes, I am. I'm 47, and it's not a rich man's disease. I've been battling this since I was 16 years old.
Where are you from, Karen?
I'm originally from Lexington, Kentucky, and I've lived in Atlanta for 14 years.
And what do you do for a living?
I worked in rock and roll. I was working for 96 Rock in Atlanta.
Okay, well, right away, you've just disqualified yourself, because if you're bouncing around in showbiz, then the forces that surround you are completely different than normal. Would you agree or disagree?
I would disagree, because I went to college. I graduated from the University of Kentucky with a degree with a pre-law major.
I'm sure you had wonderful glory days, but if you spend that much time working around rock and roll and the crazy hours that rock and roll keeps and the crazy health habits that rock and roll has never obtained or supported and all of the, shall we say, fringe benefits that come with working in show business, you're going to look like an anorexic whether you are or not. Agree or disagree?
I disagree, because when I started with my anorexia, I was before Karen Carpenter brought it to the forefront, and I wanted, it's called self-esteem, David. That's what it is.
Okay. Is a lack of self-esteem a disease,
yes.
do you
yes.
think?
It's a lack of self-esteem, and you want I wanted to look like Patty Hansen and everybody back then.
And you just took it too far?
Yes.
Okay. How did you know that you'd taken it too far?
Because I'm 5'10 and 82 pounds.
Ouch. And what kind of love life do you have now, Karen? Are you married?
I'm divorced.
Okay. Do you think the divorce had some, the being anorexic had some impact
Absolutely.
On that? And what kind of impact did it have?
It had every aspect. He said he didn't want to watch me die.
That's an interesting call there. And are you dying?
I don't think that I'm dying, but I'm...
You're more like you're disappearing.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think I count anymore.
No, you don't count to yourself, or you're just sort of disappearing little by little? And that because of that physical presence is disappearing, and you feel that you don't count because of that?
I think I live vicariously through the rock and roll musicians because I have a lot of friends.
Well, then you're right on target. You probably look like every kid who's out there today. Well, do you feel exhaustion from this? Do you feel mental trauma? Are you out of energy? Is that what you're experiencing?
Yes, I've had to have blood transfusions.
Ouch. Okay, well, this sounds like a very serious case of something here. And are you in therapy currently?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you in therapy currently?
Oh, yeah. I since I was 16, not since I've been up here in New Jersey, I'm kind of displaced at the moment. But this is not, I know you're not a therapist, but what I wanted to tell you is I thoroughly enjoy your show. I listen to you vehemently every single day. But as a matter of fact, you did come to the 96 Rock when I was working there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Karen. After the show, you want to go get something to eat? Give us the next call, Hutch. Don't mean to make fun, but we're making. Roth Radio, who are you?
I'm Phil. What's happening, Dave? Long-time fan, brother. Long-time fan.
Thanks you so much. What are you thinking?
Well, I'll tell you. It started out, I was thinking about, don't be so insensitive about manorexia, and how could you think that it was just for rich white people and whatnot.
Asked.
But you know what? You've been, you've had a couple of good calls in between there, and that last girl really kind of hit me. I feel like she got through pretty well. It's a disease, man. You know that.
Yeah.
It's not something that's just affecting rich people or white people or, you know, males or females. It's across the board, you know.
Yeah,
it
I do know.
A lot. Go ahead.
I believe that something like sickle cell anemia, yeah, that reaches across the board in tiny degrees, but it's isolated pretty much generally to a single community. And the question,
because you got a lot of genetic links involved in that.
Okay, and
I wanted
to raise the question: is this generally, is 90% of this located in wealthy white communities? Because we almost never hear about somebody of Latino descent or a black person or Asian. You just go down the list here. That routinely the faces we see in the newspaper. Sorry, go ahead.
Maybe we just don't hear about it. You know, maybe that's the kind of stuff that just doesn't make it out into the news. You know, we get a lot of attention into the, let's call it attention into the rich white community. You know, but maybe this kind of thing gets overlooked in the Latino community or in the black community or whatnot. But it's got to be across the board. But I will tell you from, not directly but indirectly, personal experience that, you know, the one of the original callers with regards to starting from sports, my girlfriend in sports through starting as early as high school, like early teen years, 12-13 years old, gymnast, you know, got to lose the weight, if you lose a couple more pounds you'll jump a little higher, blah blah blah. All of a sudden, other girls on the team, they start teaching you what kind of tricks to do to drop a couple extra pounds. You know, next thing you know, this is 15 years going, and, you know, she still looks at herself in the mirror and thinks, hey, you know, I don't like the way I look. And I think
yeah,
the most
but you know what?
I've ever seen.
I understand the humanitarian angle towards that. But doesn't it kind of go along with the sport? And aren't the parents supposed to be tuned in on this? Because if you started off talking about gymnastics. Let's talk about the compound injuries that happen there, the stress fractures, the ruined tendons, the problems with all the hips and the knee joints, et cetera, that have their beginning in those kinds of sports as well. When you start little kids off in boxing, same kind of issues come into it. You got to make the weight, and you're going to endure a certain number of injuries. Doesn't this come along with the sport? Aren't parents more aware now than ever before about this?
More aware now, for sure. I will tell you, with regards to injuries, this same little girl broke two vertebrae while she was in high school. Absolutely mind-boggling to me. But yeah, absolutely. Parents are more in tune to this and keeping kids away from sports like gymnastics and even ice skating, things like that, where it's crazy competition and make kids do insane things to themselves, to their bodies, just to try to stay focused. But the reality of it is they learn to hide it. They learn tricks from their friends. They learn tricks from their peers. They learn how to hide it. You know, no, I'm just working out. Oh, I'm eating less. Oh, I'm doing good with my diet. You know, it takes years before anybody even realizes.
That's a really good point. You make a really good effort there, man. Thanks for giving us a call. 866-313-3733. Number 13, Hutch. Somebody thinks it is a rich white thing. Go ahead, my friend.
Dave.
Yes.
Oh, excellent. I'm glad I got through. This is Sketchy Folk from New York City. How are you doing?
Extraordinary today. What do you think? Are you, do you think manorexia actually exists, or is this a publicity ploy?
I got to tell you, it's such a little indulgent white thing. You go to Afghanistan, find one anorexic person. It's not going to happen. I also think it's a little bit the same thing like as liberalism. I grew up in the Lower East Side, right? And I knew so many kids there who were little rich trust fund kids with their dad's credit card out there protesting fur, right?
Sure.
But then again, I knew the guys there from the old neighborhood with the drug dealers, whatever. They weren't like that. They weren't bleeding heart liberals. It's the same kind of thing. What do you think?
You know, I tend to think that it's isolated to a specific community at this point in time. If you have enough food, then you have the option to decide not to eat. Most people don't got enough to eat. I think it's almost that simple. If you're constantly wondering about where's the next plate of beans going to come from, or how am I going to earn enough money to feed this family or whatever, then everybody tends to clean the plate. Do you disagree?
I agree there. Let me ask you one more question. Do you think it would occur in a vacuum? Do you think somebody, if there wasn't attention, if weren't people paying attention to you, would somebody have anorexia if you weren't getting attention from the outside world, that you're starving yourself to death?
There was a great French philosopher whose name I completely forget at this point in time, who had a very famous saying. He said, "Hell is in the eyes of the others. If you play to the eyes of others, you will be in hell." Do you agree or disagree?
Exactly. I agree with that. And hey, thanks for playing. Fair warning, Dave.
God bless.
Well, take care of yourself.
Okay. Somebody make me a sandwich here.
David Lee Roth in the mornings. 92.3 Free FM.
Du hører på David Lee Roth. Roth Radio på begynnelsen av morgenen. Sjokkerende stødig. You are listening to David Lee Roth. Roth Radio, first thing in the morning. Shockingly consistent.
This is like one of the greatest gigs you could do as a musician and be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And actually, one thing that could really make it better would be if we could actually perform for you tonight. But for some reason, some of us are not allowed to do that. So I don't know what we could do about that, but I'd like to do that. And I'd like to play, but Debbie, is that allowed? No? We'd like to play with you guys. Me, Nigel? Not tonight? Pretty please? Pretty please, Debbie, no.
No,
I love
can't
you.
Can't you see my band is up there?
Oh, your band.
I
thought Bondi was being inducted tonight.
Okay, let's go to the Hall of Fame here. Between an ugly feud amongst Blondie members spilling over on stage and a rancorous letter from the absent Sex Pistols, the latest Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class did not enter quietly on Monday. The animosity even made Ozzy Osbourne, inducted with Black Sabbath, seem sedate. Hey, now there's a comment. As midnight arrived under the chandeliers of the Waldorf Astoria's Grand Ballroom, Lynyrd Skynyrd, our favorite was performing the song that launched countless cigarette lighters, Freebird, to celebrate their own induction. Also famed jazz trumpeter Miles Davis completed the honorees. Who actually saw this? This didn't make it to the TV last night. They filmed this, right?
Yeah, I think it'll be on probably tonight, maybe. I don't know.
This is going to be an interesting call if they're going to cut out that feud here, because evidently what was happening is that you have Jerry Harrison and Frank Infante, who are original members of the Blondie Band. I'm wondering out loud who wrote those songs. Okay, obviously, Deborah Harry is the hood ornament. She's the visual aspect of the band, same way that Mick is the visual aspect, arguably, of the Rolling Stones, or Bono, the visual aspect of U2. The list is very, very long. But did she write the tunes? Did she write the melodies? Did she do the chord changes? Did she sit there during the production of the albums? Did she run the band rehearsals? Did she put together the ideas for where we're going to tour and what we stand for when we do go to tour? Because all of that adds up to what is a band. And I don't think that Blondie is one person, okay? I think that Blondie is a conglomeration of people. You say the word Blondie, you think they mean the blonde chick in front. Fooled me the first time. It's not. Deborah Harry is the girl. The name of the band is Blondie. And I do believe that it's 20 years after the fact of having your first hits that that is when you are optioned to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. If I'm not mistaken, Nigel Harrison and Frank Infante were members of the original act from 20 summers or that much more long ago, and that these were the fellas who were very intimately involved with the songwriting and the production, etc. Especially Nigel, if I'm not mistaken. I think he was a keyboard player, okay? If you know what I'm talking about, 866-313-3733, call me up, fill me in, because I don't think that Deborah Harry wrote the tunes. I think that her band wrote the tunes, okay? And even if they didn't, wasn't there a combination of talent going on in there? This is not like Michelle Branch, for example, who changes bands like most people change their socks, okay? She's routinely working with people like, for example, Santana, and then she's working with her own album, and then she's on the TV show with the Schaefer Band or whatever. So when they give the award to Michelle Branch, it's not the Michelle Branch Band. Just an example. I don't know if she's ever going to win something, but you would give it to her specifically. For Barbara Streisand, nobody goes, great, and the award for the Barbara Streisand Band. With me, there's always a band involved. Even with Just a Gigolo, even with California Girls, I had genius talent like Edgar Winter in the band. I had fellas, you know, Sid McGinnis, who plays with the Schaefer Band, or did for many, many years, all right? It was a combinant effort there. We always stopped every 7 minutes and say, what do you think? What do you think? If we ever won an award for I'm Just a Gigolo, I Ain't Got Nobody, and California Girls, there would be 9 other people up on that stage with me. I wouldn't go to accept on my own, even if they said, and for the David Lee Roth solo album. Well, it wasn't exactly solo. There were a whole lot of other guys on the boat helping row the boat, so to speak. And I gotta admit that I think that in her case, in Deborah's case, she had a lot more help than people are perhaps allowing for. Okay, so go ahead and give me the first call up there, Hutch. 866-313-3733. My friend, are you a Blondie fan?
Yes, I am.
Okay, tell me what you know.
Chris Fine is the main writer for most of their stuff.
Okay. And
he's a guitar player.
And did he... Okay, creating chords and working out a general format is one thing. Was it a group effort that created the sound of Blondie as we know it?
For the most part, yeah. But like I said, Chris is definitely the one who did most of the writing.
Okay, and what? Chris has since passed away, correct?
No, I think he's still there.
Okay, was he actually on stage last night? Because there was always a lot of acrimony between him and her. They were married, or, you know, might as well have been, or something like that. And then there were problems there. And I don't think they've been performing together for a period of time. I may be mistaken here. That's why I'm saying, call and give me calls and let me know. Is Chris Stein part of that band currently?
Yes.
Okay. And when you get somebody, for example, a band like The Who or Zeppelin or Van Halen, one person would come up with the chords. Another person, myself, for example, would come up with the melody and the words, but it was a band effort that gave the finished sound. You were buying a band, not just one person's idea. Would you agree?
Right.
Would you agree that that exists for Blondie as well?
Yes.
Okay, what do you think of what happened last night? These two guys got up there. This is probably the greatest accolades that they're ever going to receive as pop musicians. This is a great shout-out, a salute many years after the fact, like the Hall of Fame for football or something. They get up there. Sounded to me like they were very genuine. They were willing to put it behind them. Hey, this is a single moment. And they were dismissed, denied. And she says to him, no, you can't sing with us, and I've got my own band. What do you think of that?
I think that's cold, man.
And what do you think their recourse is? How do you think those guys felt?
I think they probably felt pretty bad. I mean, you know, you work with people so many years, and then, you know, to get this like that at something like that, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, I think it's way out of character as far as, you know, one world, one love, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one tribe all together. Isn't
exactly.
Isn't that kind of part of the moment? And but you know what? We're seeing this. We're starting to see this a lot more frequently. I got to wonder how many more times we're going to see this coming up. What about the Sex Pistols?
Infighting, you know, destroys every good band, as you know.
What about the Sex Pistols? You think they were within their rights to send in a torch letter?
And, well, I don't think they'd be the Sex Pistols if they didn't.
Good idea. I like the way you think. Thanks for calling. 866-313-3733. Bang on it. Go ahead, Hutch. Are you a Blondie friend? Are you a Blondie fan, my friend? Hello. Hello. Go ahead. Is this Damon from Brooklyn?
Yes, it is.
And this is Deborah Harry. What do you think of my role last night?
I think you were completely out of line there.
What do you think she should have done, Damon? What do you think she should have done?
Well, she should have been gracious and let her band let the band join in, or she could have done what Alice Cooker had done, which was legally change his name so that when you make reference to Alice Cooker, you're speaking not of the entire band, but of the lead singer.
I didn't know that he had actually done that. So he owns the name as in the band as well as on his driver's license.
Yes, Vincent Bernier changed his name legally to Alice Cooper when the band had had its dissension.
See, now I have a problem with that because the initial stages of Alice Cooper was a spectacular band. It was a conglomerate sound, and inarguably he's the most famous for all of the songs that came out of that phase, right? I'm 18, School's Out, and on, everything that's in between there. And that, again, was a conglomerate sound. No one guy could have made that sound. Somebody probably wrote the chord changes, Alice might have wrote the words, but it was the band that made the sound that we bought. And you're saying now he just changed his name to it and he co-opted it. That's interesting.
Yeah. When the band was breaking up, he quickly just snatched it up by saying, look, everybody recognizes me as Alice Cooper. So he just legally changed his name. And if Deborah Harry honestly feels that she is Blondie, she could have gone that route.
Interesting call. So this is kind of what Axl Rose is attempting to, I'm afraid of choosing the right verb here, but that's what he's trying to foist. Yeah, it's the same kind of issue though, isn't it? Is that he says, I'm Guns N' Roses. Is that what's going to be on his driver's license from now on?
It wouldn't surprise me.
All right, buddy, step away from the recording console.
Mornings, David Lee Roth on 92.3 Free FM.
Roth Radio, DLR, David Lee here, New York, Philly, Dallas, Boston, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, West Palm Beach, DavidLeeRoth.com, worldwide, Kaysville, Utah, Pembroke, Ontario, Sarasota, Florida, they're all dialed in, Brooklyn, Bolivia, San Diego, California, Washington, D.C., Mentor, Ohio, Pasadena, California, hey, the hometown crew is all here, and we're talking about the show last night with Blondie. They had some difficulties when some of the original members of the band, I believe them to be original members of the band, showed up. They were invited there. They obviously didn't bum rush the door, and she refused to play with them. Uh-oh.
When I started doing, you know, rock and roll, Women's Lip was, you know, a new thing, really, basically.
Actually, Deborah, that's wrong, too. Go ahead and play that cut one more time. That's Deborah speaking. Once she dismissed the individuals from the stage here, she went ahead and made another comment here. Go ahead and play it one more time.
When I started doing, you know, rock and roll, Women's Lip was, you know, a new thing, really, basically.
Okay, according to the book In Our Time by the noted feminist Susan Brown Miller, Debbie, that happened in the 60s, okay? Starting in with banning the bra and a whole lot of other demonstrations there. And as far as cultural icons like yourself, Deborah, I think you made a contribution, but nowhere's as near as the women in the James Bond books. Nobody was as completely empowered as Pussy Galore. Nobody was as empowered as Holly Goodhead. Every bad chick in every James Bond book was a combat air pilot. They flew jets. They flew helicopters. They knew kung fu. They all spoke multiple languages. They were all right-hand people, if not bosses, of their own armies. They all revolved in completely high-tech digital technology, comfortably and at home with it well before anybody knew what digital technology was. So between the two, got a little problem with that, Deb. Also, there were a lot of girl bands before that, much less black singers, a la Billie Holiday or the Janis Joplins or anybody in between who may have made as much or more of an impression as Blondie did. I gotta wonder if she popularized the girl band thing a little bit more, but beyond that, I don't know that if she pushed the edge as far as women's lib or what have you. But as far as pushing the edge for women's lib, there's probably no better representative, of course, than Ozzy Osbourne. And we're going to listen to... slipped that one past you, didn't they don't know if I'm ever joking anymore. Let's listen to what Ozzy's take on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was here. Go ahead.
Play. When you first got your name in the list, you go, oh, we're going to win an award. And then you get knocked and you go, the next year he comes in. And it was literally every year we were put on the list, but we weren't getting voted. So you get disappointed.
Okay, you're going to ask me what he said, Animal,
that's
right?
That's what I was going to actually translate that for us, Dave, because I didn't understand but one word.
Okay, well, what he said was, Sharon, where's Jack?
That's a true Birmingham accent, Animal.
Did you understand virtually every word he said?
And you know what? I lived there for 20 years of my life. I understood about a third of that.
Okay, turn off
but
the back.
I love it, though.
Turn off the backing track. Let's listen to Ozzy do himself in one more time here. Okay, this is Ozzy Osbourne doing his best Kanye West impression, okay, of I Don't Get No Respect. Larry Holmes, part 12. Here we go.
When you first got your name in the list, you go, oh, we're going to win an award. And then you get knocked and you go, the next year he comes in. And it was literally every year we were put on the list, but we weren't getting voted. So you get disappointed.
Okay, we feel for you, Ozzy. We feel your pain. Go ahead and dial up number 10 here on this too as well, because I think we get a revisitation from Ozzy about this. Is it okay to stand up in front of somebody when you finally get an award and go, what took you so long? Have you ever showed up for a date and the girl says, what took you so long? What's your immediate reaction? I wonder what the reaction in the audience is about this. And by the way, who said you were good enough to win it before? maybe the competition just got so slim this year, Ozzy, that you finally snuck in. So, I got to raise that question here. Well, obviously, the competition is pretty high if they're putting in people like Miles Davis, all right? But, okay, so they passed you up a couple of times. Who decided in your mind that you were in the Hall of Fame? I wonder if we asked Ozzy Osbourne, did you always know and expect that you would be in the Hall of Fame? Would he give us a politically correct answer? Well, you know, I just take it game by game. Just want to help the team. Curveballs dropping just right. Arm feels good, Dave. Would we get that kind of nonsense from him then? Because this is becoming a pattern now, and people stand up and they go, hey, how come I wasn't here before? Maybe you weren't good enough before. Maybe we had to lower the bar a little bit, Oz. Play the last thing there. Go ahead.
We've been to receive it 7 times. And at the end of the day, I thought, they're never going to do it. They're never going to nominate us for an award. And lo and behold, you know, after 35 years, 40 years of being in the game, we got one.
Okay, you know what, Oz? Finally, you showed up at a memorial ceremony, and you didn't have enough class to just accept the award and sail off to the next sold-out Ozfest. This is somebody who's struggling with a self-esteem issue after how many record sales, after whatever, that's the most important thing, is that he's going to harangue the audience for this? Get out of here. This guy's crazy. 866-313-3733. What's happening to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? This is turning into professional wrestling or something. Dial in any one of these. This is all part of the same subject there, Hutch. Roth Radio, who am I talking to?
My name's Greg from Jersey.
What do you think of all this, Greg?
First of all, I got to just tell you, I love your show.
Thank you so much.
And the difference, and I know you respect Howard Stern and all that, but I will tell you this. The difference is in the humor and rudeness for the educational side of what you do.
What you guys do
is so educational, and it really is. It's great to listen to. So,
well, try and share some of the stories we've picked up along the way.
Well, the one thing I'll tell you that my wife is from Hawthorne, New Jersey, and Deborah Harry's her cousin, so she grew up with her. And I will tell you this, and you'll probably attest to this, that Deborah Harry at one point was, you're right, she's definitely the front of the band. There's no question about it. She's the blonde girl. She's the blonde chick. But at one point, she wanted to do more. She wanted to do more than just play. She wanted to write melodies. She wanted to write lyrics. She wanted to write words and stuff like that. And she got some resistance put back. You know, Chris was the front for doing all that kind of stuff. And at one point, she told us, that one of the biggest reasons why a lot of bands break up is because people want to do things that are outside their area of expertise. She said that's what people run into problems with. That's why bands break up. You know, a guy who's the front singer for a certain band and does a great job all of a sudden wants to start writing songs.
Okay, let me ask you this. Did she actually start writing songs that we're familiar with, or did she spin out?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Dave. I don't really know. I've only met her like two or three times. She's sort of an outcast with the family. But I do know for a fact that on a number of occasions, she wanted to do more than just be the front person for the band, and I think that caused problems.
Oh, I'm sure that it would cause problems, particularly if it was successful. You spend so many thousands and thousands of endless hours rehearsing, dreaming. You finally get yourself into a position where you make a couple of records. Keep in mind, people like Tito Puente did 110 records in their career. Frank Sinatra did 99 records on the Reprise label alone. So imagine when you get up to 2, 3, maybe 4 albums and somebody wants to start really revising the way things are tuned up, you're going to spread a lot of fear in people, especially if people are married or they got a good drinking problem or whatever.
Yeah, and I think she felt as if much of the success that the band had was all on her shoulders, even though she didn't write it. So when she sat back and Chris wrote the words, the lyrics were done, the melodies were done, she finally gained enough confidence to say, you know what, I'm really a success of this band and I don't like it this way and I want to change it.
Okay,
and
but did
on a number of songs.
But if she changed it and went on like Bruce Springsteen did when he stopped with the E Street Band and went on to create greatness, that's one thing. I don't think that's what happened.
I don't think that's what happened at all.
Would you agree that even though Springsteen wrote all those great tunes and the melodies and the chord changes for the stuff on Thunder Road, etc., that the E Street Band has to be on stage when he collects his Lifetime Achievement Award?
100%.
Okay, thanks for giving us a call here.
Got it, Dave. Great show, man.
Thank you. 866-313-3733. You want to take one more? Go ahead. Bang it in there, Hutch. Roth Radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing, Dave? First, I'd like to say I think that you're the epitome of a rock star. I've always told my fellow musicians that. I'm a drummer. I think you handled it really well.
Well, like I've been saying, I got to blame a lot of that on the band, but
yeah,
please continue.
You handled your title really well. The show's great. Listen, I don't think a lot of people understand how exceptional of a player you got to be to even get noticed and to be a person in the music business. And the people out there who buy records, they don't understand the aspect of business and, you know, the rights and the merchandising. And if you're a drummer like I am and you're a drummer, you're an exceptional one at that, you don't write chords. You're an additive to a band. And, you know, sometimes that can get frustrating because you can't write chords. I think that the band should be highly noticed and people, I mean, the musicians should be highly noticed and people don't really realize how hard it is, how the music business is a business. They don't understand you sell your rights. People don't realize that.
I think you have an excellent point, man. Thanks for giving us a call. One way or another, you guys belong on the stage along with the singers, don't you? Give it up there, Hutch. See you all tomorrow, one way or another.
Weekday mornings on 92.3 Free FM. 92.3 Free FM. Free is our image. Free is our state of mind. Freedom on your radio begins with JV and Elvis, middays 10 to 1.
The strength of the free world on Free FM.
Free FM.